We are proposing a budget that will shrink the bloated federal bureaucracy, and I mean bloated, while protecting our national security. You see what we're doing with our military, bigger, better, stronger than ever before. You see what's happening, and you're already seeing the results.
President Donald Trump released his budget blueprint today. Emphasis on blueprint, the official version, will not come out for a few more months now. But massive proposed cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, Housing and Urban Development, and public education could deal a painful blow to California. Trump's blueprint is so extreme that some top Republicans are already pushing back against parts of it. Still, that does not mean some version of this budget won't win approval from the Republican-controlled Congress, and that could hamstring California's efforts to reduce homelessness, reduce greenhouse gases, even just balance the budget. Here to tell us more is Evan Halper, political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Evan.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. What are the cuts that will impact Californians the most if some version of this budget is passed?
Well, there are so many of them. And you have to take in mind, like, the budget doesn't include the cuts to the Affordable Care Act. But if they repeal and replace Obamacare, that's what hits the California budget the most, because so much of the federal spending that comes to California is through Medicaid. Mm-hmm. That all said, there's almost no area that doesn't get hit in some way in California by this budget, because it cuts every federal agency, and every federal agency does something for the state. But the cuts to community development block grants, to Section 8 housing, I mean, it's a $6 billion cut at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. That will really hit hard, as will the cuts of the Environmental Protection Agency, an agency that's getting cut by 31%.
Wow, 31%. So what does that mean for California?
It means a lot of things. There's brownfield cleanup programs that'd be cut back dramatically. There's entire watershed programs, like restoration effort on San Francisco Bay, that would just get eliminated outright. In fact, there's 50 programs that would get eliminated. The budget for enforcement and environmental compliance, anti-pollution efforts, where federal investigators go out and make sure people aren't, companies and businesses are not polluting things they shouldn't be polluting, that would be cut back, I think, by a third. And so those are, environmental investigators and who just won't be out there doing that work if this budget were to come to pass.
And in terms of overall money from the federal government, how much does the state receive? How much does it rely on federal dollars?
You're testing my knowledge of the California budget, but it's about a third of the budget, and I don't have the tips of my fingers what the overall budget number is this year.
Right. Okay. So, but Jerry Brown, the governor, has made it a point of pride to have a balanced budget. He's, very fiscally conservative. He wants to keep us within the lines. What would this do to his budget?
It would make it very hard to balance. And some of this doesn't happen right away. So in some ways, Sacramento will continue doing what they do. Their budget is due June 30th. This fight is going to be going on in Washington long past then. So basically what I think you're going to see is California is just going to continue along and pass a budget as if none of this is happening, because they don't know exactly what's going to pass and what isn't going to pass. But sometime after that budget gets put in place, Washington will agree on something, presumably. And whatever that is, it's unlikely to be this Trump budget plan, because so many Republicans are already pronouncing it dead on arrival. But, you do have a Republican Congress that wants to cut a lot. And, this president, this White House, obviously wants to cut quite a bit. And there will be pain inflicted on California.
So people are comparing this budget to Ronald Reagan's budget when he was president. Is that an apt comparison, this big buildup in defense and cutting social services?
Yeah, the last time the federal government tried to do anything this ambitious in terms of shifting so much of spending over to the military was when Reagan was president. But even Reagan's first budget, which was really hard on the state, doesn't compare to what's going on here right now, because so much is happening at once. I mean, you have everything you're talking about that, that Reagan did back then, but then layer on top of that the Affordable Care Act repeal, this push to build a wall on the border, this threat that, sanctuary cities will be defunded, and you just have all these other things going on. And, if everything this White House envisioned were to come to pass, I mean, it would be be so much more dramatic than what Reagan did.
Wow. Okay. Let us drill down now and talk about two of the areas that Evan has mentioned, housing and the environment. And let's begin with housing. Steve Renahan is on the line. He works on housing and homelessness in Los Angeles. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Okay, so Evan mentioned cuts to community development block grants. What does that mean?
Well, for housing, the even more important cut is to the home program. The president proposes to zero out the home program.
What is that? That's
a program that provides capital money to cities and counties to produce affordable housing. And the way L.A. City and L.A. County have used that money is to produce permanent supportive housing for persons experiencing chronic homelessness. That's people who've been homeless for a long time and have disabling conditions. And research has proven that this is the most effective intervention for chronically homeless individuals. And the president proposes to zero that out.
Okay. So meanwhile, we passed Measure HHH in November, which would provide more housing for the homeless. So would that be affected?
We will produce fewer units of permanent supportive housing if the president's budget is approved than we would have even with the HHH. The HHH money was anticipated to be leveraged with home money so we could produce more units. And if that home is zeroed out, we won't be able to do that. Another major impact would be the Section 8 program. That's the program where HUD funds local housing authorities to provide rent subsidies for low-income families and individuals. And the president proposes to flat fund that. Unfortunately, with the Section 8 program, costs go up every year because the tenants pay 30% of their income toward rent, and low-income tenants' incomes tend not to increase while rents keep going up, so the subsidies have to keep going up every year. So even flat funding is a cut. And the impact here will be devastating to our homeless programs because our L.A. City and County housing authorities have been quite innovative in using their vouchers to work with community-based agencies to rehouse homeless families and individuals. So the housing authority provides that rent subsidy, and the community-based agencies provide ongoing support so that the rehoused homeless can stay housed. If the Section 8 program is flat-funded, they won't be able to do that anymore.
And so presumably more people couldn't afford their rent, which would mean that more people would find themselves homeless, but then you have this cut in homeless housing. So then what?
Then we would have more homeless people in Los Angeles than we would otherwise. Now, Measure Triple H, as you mentioned, will help because we will produce units of permanent supportive housing, just not as many as could be produced if the president were cutting these programs.
And could the state make up any of this money?
It would be very difficult for the state to make up this money given the budget situation in Sacramento right now.
Okay, let's turn now to the environment. That was another big issue that Evan mentioned, and Sean Hecht is here now. He studies environmental law at UCLA. California has obviously been a leader in the fight against climate change. Now, with this EPA funding potentially being slashed by a third, according to what Evan told us, what will that mean for specifically for California?
It will have some pretty serious and specific effects on California if EPA isn't able to maintain its programs here. A lot of our regulation of air and water quality and greenhouse gases that cause climate change is done at the state level by state agencies, but a lot of what those state agencies do is they implement federal EPA programs, and those programs, of course, rely on funding and other resources from the federal government for their implementation. And so without seeing the details of the budget proposal, it's hard to know exactly how it will impact those programs. There's no question that a dramatic downsizing of EPA staff and downsizing of the EPA's budget is going to reduce both the money and the other resources, and both scientific resources and enforcement resources and other resources that the state has to protect public health and the environment here.
Right. And then there's also talk about the EPA no longer allowing California to have a waiver when it comes to regulating greenhouse gases. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So California has special authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate mobile source emissions of pollutants. and went to those mobile sources are cars, trucks, pretty much anything that moves rather than is stationary like a power plant. And because California was already regulating emissions into the air from those sources before the Clean Air Act was passed, the Clean Air Act was written to give California this special authority to do that. And it has exercised that authority over the years to essentially regulate emissions from cars at a different level than the federal government, and often the federal government has caught up to California's level. Here specifically, this is about emissions of greenhouse gases, which is often correlated with fuel economy in cars, and so our federal fuel economy standards are going to be loosened. The president announced yesterday basically that he was going to revisit and essentially roll back the fuel economy standards at the federal level for cars, and it seems quite likely, based on what most observers have seen and believe the federal government's going to do, that the government is unlikely to allow California to continue to use its special authority to regulate greenhouse gases from cars. And I'm sure the state will fight that. The state's on solid legal ground with the actions it's taken in the past, and these waivers have always been approved in the past, with one exception during the Bush administration, which was then overturned by the Obama administration. So it would be really unprecedented at this point for the federal government to take that step.
Okay, thank you for that. Now let's turn to Mike Janess. He's a Republican. He headed the Department of Finance under former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And you were quoted in the LA Times today saying the cuts are so deep they would throw the state budget into a level of disarray not seen since the Great Recession. Is that still your sense after seeing the blueprint that came out today?
No, not at all. As Evan said, the big thing that's still pending is what happens with Obamacare, the repeal and replace. That has a direct impact. At least it's been announced that it's going to have a direct impact on Medicaid. So that was the most potentially devastating to the state budget of any of the things that had been discussed that were on the table, and that apparently isn't in the president's budget, but we all know that shoe is going to drop at some point. The state can't really afford to continue paying for the Medicaid program as it is. The only reason that we've been able to afford to continue paying for what we call Medi-Cal in California is the generosity of the federal government. They've given us pots of money and ways of creating new federal money that have bailed out the state, because without those we never could have kept up with the growth of Medi-Cal. And in the future, I don't see a prospect of that kind of generosity continuing. So we're going to have a Medi-Cal crisis in the state of California, whether it's next year because of the passage of Obamacare repeal and replace, or because they're just not going to continue to be as generous with their federal funds, and eventually we're going to have to do something to stop the growth in Medi-Cal, or we're going to take away the rest of the state budget and put it into Medi-Cal because it's growing at a rate much greater than our revenues are going to grow.
So it appears that with this federal cuts that we've been talking about in this segment, that either the state tries to make up some of them or they just go through, affecting mainly the most vulnerable people in California. And so what does that say to you? Will California just let that happen, or do you think there's going to be some state taxes that will be raised?
Well, we're talking with the assumption that the entire thing is enacted as stated, and whether that happens or not, I don't know.
But if some version of this happens, which
if that
seems
were to
likely
happen, I don't see the state having any fiscal capacity to bail out a substantial amount of these reductions. There will certainly be some effort to do so. There'll be a lot of discussion about the policy. But in the final analysis, I don't think the state has the wherewithal to replace, for example, the low-income home energy assistance program that's been zeroed out, or the community services block grant that's been zeroed out. So if those are in fact zeroed out, I think they're just going to, those services will just go away.
Do you see anything good in this budget blueprint?
Absolutely. I think the expansion of the military is necessary. We're not growing it back to anything like we had at the end of the Cold War with this budget. We're just trying to restore a credible deterrence. And I think that, if you ask yourself, how can the federal government maintain a budget that has deficits like this out into the infinite future? We're about to cross the $20 trillion threshold, that means more and more borrowing from not only our own citizens but from around the world. How is that possible? Well, one reason that it's possible is that people know we have the strongest military in the world, and as a result, we're a very safe place to stash your money. So we're the world's reserve currency, in large part because we're the world's superpower. And we're, without these augmentations to the federal, to the military budget, we're in danger of no longer being the world's superpower. And that could have devastating effects on our ability to fund not just these programs, but lots of other programs.
And locally, because we have many military bases here in California, is that a good thing for at least those bases and for the people who work and live around them?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the thing about budget cuts. You look at the budget cuts, and you can have very precise, you know, this homeless program will stop. These people will no longer get their low-income home energy assistance. You can put your finger on it. You can point at exactly what's going to happen. When you do budget balancing, the effects are diffuse around the entire economy. So not only will the military spending have some benefit in California just from a countercyclical, you know, spending perspective, but getting the federal budget into balance and getting regulations reduced dramatically should have a very large benefit on our economy. You may not be able to point at a job that somebody got and say that's because of the Trump budget or that's because of the deregulations, but overall you're going to have a much higher rate of growth in the economy if you do some of these things.
All right. We'll leave it there. Mike Genest, former director of the State Finance Department under Governor Schwarzenegger, thank you for coming onto the show today. Sean Hecht, we heard from, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. Also joining us on the show, Steve Renahan, senior policy advisor at Shelter Partnership. And we started it all off with Evan Halper, political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And we want to hear your thoughts about the President's budget proposal. You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Shenny Jardin is here to talk about the Yahoo hack, allegedly by Russians, and what it means in the big picture. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We talked about the winners and losers in Trump's proposed budget. Two of the big winners are defense and homeland security. They would receive big funding increases for cybersecurity. Meanwhile, the U.S. government charged Russian spies with cyber crimes for the first time. And here to talk about all this is our cyber queen, our cyber warrior, Shenny Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi.
Here I come to save the internet.
Okay, so $1.5 billion, that sounds like a lot for cybersecurity and perhaps a good thing because we don't want hackers hacking into our systems.
Hey, and you know, if there's one person that knows about what a menace Russian hackers would be, it's probably Donald Trump. This is all so very interesting. So in the draft budget released today, $1.5 billion to protect federal networks and critical infrastructure. So what this tells me is that, you know, if you strip away the partisanship and the bloviating and the posturing, they're essentially extending what happened under President Obama in terms of expanding our nation's intelligence and our nation's military reach and law enforcement reach into the domain of cyber. It's kind of funny to talk about what this means.
That's different than protecting from outside hackers, is what you're saying.
Well, you can accomplish both with the same tools and with the same budgets and with the same processes. So if we're now going to be living in a country where police departments and the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Patrol, other agencies that are involved in law enforcement and surveillance, if they're all sort of talking with each other and sharing information with each other, one could argue that great things could come out of this. So if a Russian state-sponsored Russian hacker attacks a technology company in Silicon Valley, perhaps there would be a quicker channel to look at other blips on the radar that might exist with federal agencies. But the concern that so many of us have is that information sharing generally doesn't lead to the protection and expression of our civil liberties. This is, and especially under a leader and under an administration that has proved to be as mercurial as that of Donald Trump.
So part of the budget and part of the DHS funding would go toward sharing cyber,
yep,
quote, incident information with, mm-hmm, other federal agencies in the private sector.
So I think what they're talking about there are massive hack attacks, like the hack of Yahoo that revealed half a billion user accounts. We should talk about more about that in a moment. But I think the plan here is to strip down the walls. I mean, Trump is about building walls in some places and stripping, mm-hmm, them down in others. And this gives the federal government an unobstructed line of sight into whatever local, closer, granular, on-the-ground data gathering that local agencies might be doing.
But he would still have to operate within the law against spying on American citizens, for example.
Well, there's a lot of questions now about whether Donald Trump and his administration are, in fact, operating within the law. And those are questions that take time to clarify. These things don't move through the courts particularly quickly. So I think the question with this issue and with all of the other issues that this shocking budget raises for people like us today is how much irreversible change could happen quickly. You know, it takes less time to open up the floodgates than it does to close them back up.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned over time is that whether you like our presidents or don't like our presidents, each of them, one after the other, has built upon the spying powers, the militarization of our law enforcement. This is sort of a trend that's bigger than any one personality. But do we want to live in a place where everybody just assumes that everything that they're saying is being listened to and that privacy and liberty in those very personal respects doesn't matter anymore? It may not be up to us whether those things change or not.
Okay, let's talk about this Yahoo hack and the action by the Justice Department to,
yeah,
indict these two Russians, accusing them of mounting this massive cyber attack. I mean, this
is
incredible.
Stuff.
The thefts of all sorts of emails from all sorts of different people, including journalists, including heads of industry,
yes,
political figures. For what purpose?
Well, we're not sure yet, but boy, yesterday was a very, very interesting day if you're into hacking and intrigue involving Russia and Trump. So two Russian intelligence officers and two contract hackers who, it appears, were essentially hired by the Russian government are charged by the Department of Justice with masterminding the giant Yahoo hack that exposed 500 million, that basically stole account information for 500 million. Boy, there was just so many interesting little details. Boy, yesterday was an interesting news day, wasn't,
uh-huh,
it? But if you, like, there's just
as
so many
today,
big issues all day long. But I don't want us to lose sight of the gems that were in the indictment papers that made their way to the web early yesterday morning. One of the details that I loved was that they itemized the Bentleys that, like, hackers love super expensive sports cars. And these guys had Bentley race cars with vanity plates. And they were describing all of this crazy kind of dictator gangster chic lifestyle stuff, these trappings that this.
How did they get all this money? Did they sell the information they hacked?
Yeah, yeah. So I think part of how intelligence agencies were able to track these chuckleheads down is that they were selling the information that they hacked on the secondary market. And you slip up. Like, hackers have problems with greed and vanity, and that's usually what trips them up. Kim.com's case was another one where his crazy, over-the-top, lavish lifestyle, I can get away with everything, I'm omnipotent because I own your email, that tripped him up as well. But yeah, this is the biggest sort of cyber case that the U.S. has ever taken on. 500 million accounts is profound, and the trickle-down damage from that is profound. And I think we're also, as a nation, looking at very clearly now, what role did Russia's official or unofficial cyber army play or not play in the elections and in the finances of the Trump organization and everything in Trump's orbit. So there hasn't
been a direct link made between these two hackers in the Yahoo case.
Not yet.
And the DNC hacks.
Yeah, but it was sort of I mean, come on. This news broke the same morning that senators were holding hearings to discuss possible ties between Trump and Russia. I don't think the timing is a coincidence. They're going for blood. Like, they have wanted posters in Russian for these guys. The gloves are off. This is an escalation. Many people were saying this is not a conclusion, but this is an escalation. And I think it's a very interesting breadcrumb in a week that's been full of breadcrumbs. Mm. I don't know where any of this stuff is leading to. I want to be very clear about that. I've got no idea what's going on, but I'm enjoying the ride. Because, like, seriously, I just want to say one more thing, too. But beyond whatever happens with this insane case that I'll be following closely and I'll look forward. You know, we talked about the Yahoo hack when it happened. I remember sitting
times.
Right here. A number of Press Play episodes. But don't stay on the internet too long and don't watch TV too long, because all this stuff will make you crazy. And, there's still good stuff on the internet. Right? There's still, like, dog rescue stories, and there's cat pictures, and you can share recipes with people. You can have a wholesome day on the internet.
You can?
It's possible. It requires a lot of blocking software. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is limit your interaction with stuff that makes you crazy, because we're living in crazy times. It's good to seek comfort and to remember that all you see on the internet is not necessarily real.
Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, one of the good things on the internet. Let me just say that. And our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, filmmaker Adam Curtis has some sharp words if you're depressed at the state of the world right now.
No one has another picture of an alternative future. We just accept it as normal. We know that quite a lot of it is corrupt, and we know a lot of it is fake, yet we just accept it, and we do nothing about it.
We'll talk about his latest film, Hypernormalization, his take on how we got here, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A buzzword among liberals these days is normalization, as in what's happening now with President Donald Trump is not normal. But for British filmmaker Adam Curtis, not normal began decades ago in the 1970s with decisions made by the rich and powerful, guided by cultural trends and tech innovations, all culminating today in the sense that the world is broken. He lays out his argument in his most recent film, Hypernormalization. Here's a clip.
This film will tell the story of how we got to this strange place. It is about how over the past 40 years, politicians, financiers, and technological utopians, rather than face up to the real complexities of the world, retreated. Instead, they constructed a simpler version of the world in order to hang on to power. And as this fake world grew, all of us went along with it, because the simplicity was reassuring.
What you just heard was Adam's political, social, cultural commentary, which continues over a mixture of news clips, pop culture artifacts, and all kinds of found footage. Hypernormalization first aired on the BBC to much acclaim last year. It's screening this weekend at CineFamily, along with other events surrounding Adam Curtis's work. And he's in town to speak at some of those events, and he's here with me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that term, hypernormalization. It's actually a term that came from the old Soviet Union. Can you describe what that means?
Well, it came from a man called Alexei Yerchak, wrote a brilliant book describing the last days of the Soviet Union back in the 1980s. And what he described was a society where everyone knew that it was failing. They knew it was corrupt. They knew the people in charge of it, the politicians, had no faith in the system any longer. They knew the managers were looting the system. They knew that inequality was growing. But because they had no other picture of any alternative, they just accepted this as normal, even though they knew that it was wrong. And he gave it this term, hypernormal, or hypernormalization. And in the film that you've just played a clip from, I'm not trying to suggest that we are the same as the Soviet Union. What I'm trying to suggest is that actually we may be at a very similar stage in our own society, because we all know that there is a great deal of corruption going on. I mean, the fallout from the 2008 financial crisis shows this, but then nothing is done. No one's really prosecuted. A few people are, but mostly. And the system carries on as it is. But because no one, and that includes the liberals on the left as much as those on the right, no one has another picture of an alternative future, we just accept it as normal. And so I think in a way we are in our own period of hypernormalization. We know it's a bit odd. We know that quite a lot of it is corrupt, and we know a lot of it is fake. Yet we just accept it, and we do nothing about it.
You begin your story in two cities, in two different parts of the world, New York City and Damascus, in 1975. Two distinct events that ushered in this modern era. One, the bankruptcy of New York City. Two, this meeting between Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, and Henry Kissinger. What was it about those two instances that gave us today?
You have to choose to start a story somewhere. But I think that those two events sum up what I was trying to show in hypernormalization, which is power has shifted away from politicians. That began to happen in this country in 1975 with the financial crisis in New York, because power shifted to the bankers. The city actually gave power to the banks, and the banks imposed what they called austerity. It's a word we now know a great deal about. That was a moment when that power shifted away from the politicians, and in the process, the politicians retreated from trying to manage the world and gave it away, while still pretending that they had the power. At the same time, in Damascus, what was happening is that Kissinger, who was then the Secretary of State, was doing what he saw as the only way to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem, which was to divide. He divided Egypt, took it away from the rest of the Arab world, pushed it into a separate peace with Israel. Hafez al-Assad, who was the president of Syria at that time, the father of the present president, saw this as tragic. I mean, he was an ambitious man as well. He wanted power. But he also saw it, dividing the Arab world would unleash, he said, demons underneath. And I think why I make the comparison with finance is that the financiers see a city like New York or the world as a system that they can manage by giving you credit and sending it all along little lines and managing you and keeping the world stable. Kissinger saw the world as a global system of power. He was a cynical pragmatist. And he saw the Middle East as a system that if he divided it like this and kept everything in a state of slightly jittery stability, then actually you could damp everything down and it would remain stable. What Assad was arguing to him is, you can do that, but you're going to let forces out that will come out and bite you. And I think that's what's happened. So what I was trying to show at that point is that you were retreating from the old political idea that you could change things properly, and replacing it with the idea that you could turn the world into a system and just hold it stable. And in the process, we retreated into our own little dream world, thinking that everything was okay. And that includes us, all of us. But what was festering underneath was the sort of dynamic chaos of reality. And it's burst through now, and it's bursting through in all sorts of ways. And what I'm really arguing in the film is that because we retreated into this simplified idea of the world, we now lack the ability to even understand those forces that are bursting through. We have no idea what to do with Syria, because it's not a world of goodies and baddies that we were brought up to believe the world was. It's a complicated society, just like yours and mine, which when you pull it apart, just starts to eat itself. And we just don't understand that. And with the financial system, we have no idea what to do with it. We're in its thrall, but even those who run it don't understand what to do. It's sort of flatlining at the moment. It's just going along, hoping that we'll keep on consuming.
One of the points that you make in the film is this idea that you've been talking about in terms of perception versus reality and how the elites mess with that for their own particular gains. And one central figure who illustrates this is Muammar Gaddafi in your film. And I just found it fascinating how you presented him as a willing puppet of the United States, willing to be cast as, you know, this evil despot who was bent on committing acts of terror, even when he really wasn't.
In the film, I find Gaddafi, in a way, the sort of truth teller about the world I'm trying to lay out for you in the film. Because if you go back to the early 1980s, when President Reagan came to power in the United States, the forces that were being unleashed in the Middle East of terrorism, many of which came directly from Syria or were proxies for Syria, the United States just couldn't deal with it. And in 1984, they retreated. They, after the bombing of the Marine barracks in the Lebanon, they just retreated. And in the face of that, what I think happened is the United States and other countries in Europe simplified the Middle East. They just couldn't face the complexities of what had been unleashed. And they, what they did is they turned it into a battle of good versus evil. This was very central to President Reagan's view of the world anyway. And they looked for a person who could do this, and they found Gaddafi. And Gaddafi was almost a comic character at that point, and no one cared about him. Why it was willing, he wasn't so much a puppet, it was almost like a collaboration, is that the Reaganites wanted someone who they could portray as an evil figure. Gaddafi, who was desperate to publicise both himself and his ideas about the world, basically went along with it. He sort of said to himself, I'll play this role. And he did. He played the mad despot, the mad dog of terror, as he was called. Mm-hmm. And together they collaborated in this. And why I find it interesting is because the story of Colonel Gaddafi is that how he is cast as this horrible mastermind of terror. He plays along with it until 2003, when after the invasion of Iraq, everything went rather badly wrong for both America and Britain. And they searched desperately for someone who would portray, who would show that their invasion had started a process of democratization in the Middle East. And yet again, Gaddafi turned around and said, I'll do that. And he immediately said, I'll give up my weapons of mass destruction. He didn't really have any weapons of mass destruction. He had a few old leaking barrels of mustard gas. Other than that, he had nothing. But he said, I'll give them up. And the British and the American leaders went out to see him and said, this is fantastic, this is wonderful. We are having an effect. So again, they were collaborating. At which point, and it's a real, it's like a snapshot of the hypocrisy and the corruption of the establishment in my country. Everyone went out to see Colonel Gaddafi. It was famous television presenters went out to see him, philosophers, university professors, journalists. I think even Lionel Richie went out to sing to him. Everyone went to see this new hero because he was this heroic figure who was democratizing his country. Then came the Arab Spring in 2011, which suddenly you had the victim, the noble victims rising up against despots, at which point the American and the British establishments decided that Colonel Gaddafi was an evil figure in this new narrative of good versus evil, and they turned on him. And in the film, I have an interview with his son, Saif, who is very blunt about the hypocrisy of not just the right-wing hawks in the British government, but the liberals as well. Just how they, on a sixpence, they turned around on him and just condemned him. And actually, the drone that spotted Gaddafi and the planes that bombed him came from the West. They went and killed him. And I just think at the centre of all this story, the story of Colonel Gaddafi is a sad, tragic story of a man who sort of wanted to reach for glory through doing what the West wanted. And he did it again and again. And then at the end, the West just turned around and killed him. And that says a lot about us.
So you chose to begin your film in 1975. You could have chosen to begin it centuries ago or maybe a little earlier with colonization. There are all sorts of threads you could have chosen to lead up to this present moment. But you chose 1975. Why?
No, I chose it because at the heart of my film is what happened as the liberal post-war dream that you could manage the world through politics and control it and plan it failed. And that happened in the mid-1970s with an economic crisis and a crisis of confidence amongst the liberals. I mean, I think one of the really fascinating and unexamined areas of our life is how the liberal elite, in my country as well as yours, lost confidence somewhere in the 1970s and turn from being optimists about the idea that you could use politics to change the world, not just at home, but abroad, and within 10 years became dark pessimists, frightened of everything, with no vision of the future. And I call them Odierists. It's a sort of slightly sarcastic term, but it's liberals now have their coffee, look at the newspaper, and they go, look, another boat of refugees has turned over in the Mediterranean. And then there's a pause, and they go, oh dear. I mean, I'm being silly, but there is a sort of an important unexamined thing here, is the liberals are so powerful, so influential, and had a very powerful dream up until the mid-1970s. And then suddenly they lost it. And I know the world shifted off to the right, and Mrs. Thatcher came along, and President Reagan came along. But somehow the liberals just gave up. And in a way, one of the things I'm trying to push in this film is a sort of a message saying, look, if you really do want to change the world, you've got to come up with a positive vision of the world. You can't just go on saying, oh dear, because if you keep on going on saying, oh dear, and then going off and drinking artisanal coffee, you leave the people who are really hurting and are really anxious about the future totally neglected. And they turn round and they vote for Donald Trump and they vote for Brexit. And you are paying the price for saying, oh dear.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Adam Curtis is a filmmaker with the BBC and his films, and he will be at CineFamily all weekend long. Coming up, Randy Sklar will be here to talk about March Madness and who he thinks can take the whole thing. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
That means one thing and one thing only, sports time, and the Sklar brothers' brother today. Randy Sklar is here. Sans Jason. So let's talk about March Madness, of course. USC played the first four
play-in game, which is a relatively new concept. It was originally the field of 64. There were 64 teams, and so you go through a round, first round, second round, then Sweet 16, Elite Eight, that's next weekend, and then the final four, the semifinal game, and then the championship game ends on a Monday. But they decided to add, to expand the field a little bit. They felt like there are a couple of worthy teams that were not let in year after year, so we'll add four more teams and have them do what's called almost like, it's like a play-in game. You play another team the night before the tournament starts on Wednesday night for the chance to then jump into the field of 64.
This is called March Madness creep.
Yes. It just, slowly.
It's going to then be in February.
I mean, it's like, you know, Christmas shopping earlier and earlier every year.
So did they win?
USC won. They were down by 17 to a really difficult and tough Providence team, but they came back and won. And you think of USC as a football school, and now they had a great football year this year, and they look like they're set to be great for a long time. Great recruiting, really good young players on the teams. You don't think of them as a basketball school. They had a couple of good teams in years past. I don't know how great they're going to do and how long of a run they'll have when you have to play that extra game. In order to win the tournament, you have to win a lot of games. You know, you really do. You got to win the first round, the second round, and then the Sweet 16, and the Elite Eight, and the Final Four. And you got to win six games. It's a very difficult thing to win six in a row against this type of competition. With a play-in game, you got to win seven. So I think it's going to be tough, and I don't think USC has the talent to go up against some of these tougher teams. So they slide in, and I think they're going to have a rougher road. But UCLA, on the other hand, the other Los Angeles school, I think has a legitimate shot to potentially win it all. I mean,
really?
They are
win the
really
whole
good
thing. They're playing tomorrow night against Kent State.
Right, they're a three seed. Now they're in a difficult sort of region, as we, you know, as you want to call it. They are in a region with University of North Carolina, which always has a great team and really great players.
So they're not
players.
In USC's region?
No.
That's very confusing.
Well, but
to me.
No, it's okay, because that what's nuts is that, like, they're in, you know, UCLA could be in like the East region. It just, what they do is the NCAA ranks the top 68 teams, says here they are in order, and then they move around the pieces to make the setups and make the matchups. And so it happens in a way that it has nothing to do with where you are. In fact, they don't want you to have an unfair advantage. Sometimes it happens. Like, they don't
want... It's like air traffic control. I don't want to know.
Right. Just know that the planes are not going to run into each other. Okay. So anyway, I just think UCLA has a legitimate shot. They've got an amazing player named Lonzo Ball, who is going to be in a lottery pick in the NBA draft. He's a freshman. They have another freshman, TJ Leaf, who is incredible. They have a lot of really great players. Steve Alford, who's the coach, his son is a senior this year and a leader. And they just have a lot of athletes and then a lot of older players to ground the team. I think this team can make a very, very deep run. Now, the crazy thing is Lonzo Ball's dad, LeVar Ball, is nuts, like the Williams sisters' father. Remember, he was Richard Williams. He was like just kind of a domineering personality, and so
stage dad, yeah,
almost, yeah, in a sports sense. So they have he's got a younger brother, Lonzo Ball, LaMelo Ball, who plays for Chino Hills, scored 92 points in a high school game this year.
Really?
92 points. Now, remember, Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in an NBA game. That was amazing. 92 points. Is an unbelievable amount. So this kid may be even better than Lonzo. That's LaMelo. So LeVar Ball, who at games sits there and is interviewed on the sidelines, said that currently Lonzo Ball is better than Steph Curry of the former champion Golden State Warriors, who was the MVP of the NBA. He said, put Steph Curry on UCLA and put my son on Golden State, and we'll see who does better.
Wow.
Now, that is bravado right there.
Come on,
those are some Lonzo Balls right there.
I didn't want to say it.
That's right.
Also, he wants a $1 billion
shoe deal. So I say all that because he requests that a $1 billion shoe contract go to his sons, which ridiculous. But who knows? What if they're that good? If they're that good, then
what's a billion dollars?
What's $1 billion in 5 years? Exactly.
You would know that. Jason.
We're quabbling. We're squabbling over that every week, Madeline. And it's really coming from our NPR paychecks.
Well, yeah.
Do you know they're paying
us? Longer.
They're paying us billions of dollars. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's talk about the women. They also have an NCAA tournament.
Yes. And, you know, while there is a lot of competition in the women's tournament, I would be remiss. I mean, I can't sit here and not say that I think that the UConn women are gonna not win the whole thing. They're gonna win the whole thing.
They always win.
They do. That'd be the biggest story, one of the biggest sports stories of the year if the UConn women lost. But they are not gonna lose. They're gonna win this tournament. And it's gonna be Gino Auriemma, who's a cocky coach. He's the coach of that team. And it's interesting because he's a man coaching a women's team. There are a lot of women coaches in the NCAA women's game, and he's like a man who's in there and just dominating. So there's like in my opinion, there's a little weirdness to that as well, but he's just an amazing coach, and the team's great, and the girls stay for 4 years, so they learn the system, and he gets the best talented players every year. It's almost like, how are you going to penetrate that fortress of amazingness? And you just are not going
to. Okay, so UConn for the women, and you're saying UCLA for the men?
Look, I think UCLA's got a shot. I definitely think you got to watch out for Arizona, who won the Pac-10 championship, but Kansas is always tough. UNC, always tough. Duke had a nice run in the ACC tournament.
Okay, I'm going to just get you to commit to one.
To one?
Yes.
If I had to pick one?
Yes.
Wait, my school, University of Michigan, won the Big Ten tournament, and they're a 7 seed, and a 7 seed has never won. A seed that high has never won. I'm going to say Michigan's going to win it all.
Okay.
That's my hope.
Okay.
But I think it's going to be
that
Arizona.
Was on tape. We're going to play
yes!
it back.
Play
We're going to play it back when you come back. Randy Sklar of the comedy duo The Sklar Brothers. You can check out their new podcast on Feral Audio, F-E-R-A-L.
Mm-hmm. It's
Feral
on iTunes Audio. For free as well.
Good. It's called Dumb People Town. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Christian Bordahl is here now sitting in for Julie Myers. Hi.
Hey there, Madeline. So the big news today was this Trump-proposed budget. We asked people what they thought of it. Suzanne Aguayo said, scorched earth policy. They go for broke and wait to see how much we will push back. Sandra called it a bulldozer, senseless and destructive. I just wanted to mention that in addition to all the things we talked about, the budget also eliminates all the money, federal money, for the National Endowment for the Arts and quote-unquote public broadcasting.
And CBB, of course, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
And the NEH.
And the NEH, yes. So we'll feel that hit if all that money really does go away, but the people that are really hurt are the rural, small TV and public radio stations. They're the ones who really depend on that money.
Right, they get most of that, most of their budget from CBB, and that costs what all three of those would be about $3 per person per year-ish. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.